Either have to talk loud or somebody will. I heard too many lies with this ear, apparently. You can ask any kind of question. The NBC interrogator asked me if my children were illegitimate. I said, well, I don't know any illegitimate children. It's impossible. I said to him afterward, would you ask that of a man, how many illegitimate children? Well, he said, no, I wouldn't.
Lois, can you hear all right? No? Yes? No? Well, we'll move this a little bit.
They can't?
She said yes.
Everybody? Okay? All right.
Speaking of my personal relationship to the Socialist Party, unfortunately they were mostly men, so you can understand what their position was. I don't think you'd do away with male supremacy, you know, by a law or even by a belief. You know, there's a wonderful book out now about one of the great socialist organizers, Kate Richard O'Hare, and she was one of the great, she organized socialism in Oklahoma almost single-handed, a great speaker, and yet she was not ever admitted on the National Committee, or treated really badly in many ways. This is I don't think even in revolutionary countries you're going to have women position change, you know, change suddenly. It's an old. If I was a man, I'd see that it never changed. You know, because they have it really good. I think it's one of the struggles like racism. Racism doesn't disappear by law or something. And racism is a very old stratagem of the ruling class. It's not going to disappear in a minute. I mean, I don't even think that the bourgeois character is going to disappear in a minute. Lenin said it would take 100 years to take the salesman out of people. And that's only true in America. There should be a good study of that, I think, of women in the labor section in the University of Wisconsin. I think his name is Barron. He's doing a lot of good work about women in the Socialist Party. And then there's another one. Many new young people are doing wonderful history now. There's another one in Omaha. Pratt, his name is, who's done a study of women in the trade unions in Omaha, including the stockyards and the railroad. There's material now that's being developed. It's really wonderful. I waited all my life to see that come out. There's really wonderful young people writing about labor history, all this dark period of history that's not known. I was in North Dakota last year. North Dakota at one time was a socialist state. For 1 year, North Dakota was a socialist state. You don't learn that in school, I'm sure. Well, I was talking to the people that just graduated in history in North Dakota. They never heard of it. Now, that would take a lot of work to keep that a secret. You know, you'd have to really work at it. I spent the whole night explaining to them, what the Nonpartisan League, it was called. And they actually voted in a socialist for 1 year. It took a world war to smash it. It was only smashed by the world war, as they smashed the German Socialist Party, and it took a war. So are you a historian? Why give it? Used to be. We really need that. We really need them.
Speak up a little.
Yeah. it's a wonderful thing, the development of world consciousness. It's not even, you can't even predict it or even analyze it. Of course, the same thing is happening everywhere. The colonial power creates a colonial consciousness of the people because they actually can't live anymore. So I think this is the most wonderful period that I ever lived. Lots of people feel depressed and this is terrible, but I've never lived in a time when there was so much consciousness of the people about what was happening and about their power and their decision to live. And the decision to protect their consciousness and protect the whole struggle we've had for centuries to create what we call a people or humanity or whatever we want to call it. I really think that, I don't think that I belittle the dangers of the bomb. I understand that it's very dangerous. I understand there's the ruling classes are in despair. Capitalism doesn't work anymore. I mean, somebody's bringing me the New York Times, and I'm getting real sympathetic towards capitalists. I mean, they're moaning in the New York Times. I mean, they don't know what to do. I mean, they're against each other. Everyone has it doesn't work, that's all. We have the power of abundance now, and you can't stop it. Capitalism is based on scarcity. And now you can have abundance. The machine that we have now could make for everyone on the globe. Food could be, land. You really have the tools for a complete abundance of a superior life than has ever been lived on the world. Communication of knowledge, instant communication. And I just think that it's just going to happen, that those powers are enormous. And the capitalist class is committing suicide, I think. I'm really disappointed in them. I should think they must be, intelligent. The capitalist. It turns out that they're retarded idiots. I mean, they can't save themselves. So I really feel like, I hope I live 10 years, to see this. I think it's going to be a tremendous, never been seen before, a transformation, one of those transformations that science now talks about in the particle, which you can't account for, or something new enters the atom, something new enters the particle, and a new form is created. I mean, this kind of thought in science, physical science, to me is, I was raised on mechanical Darwinism, one went straight to five, and you could count on counting, and it was all, but that science now says you're looking at something you can't measure, something that is energy that you can't measure, you can't count, you don't know what it's moving, how it's moving, you don't know how it exists or how it generates. It's a new thing in the world, a new consciousness, I think.
Do you think that will impact the population explosion that we're experiencing, which seems people predict that it's going to continue to occur, the increase in population?
What? Oh, the population? No, it's not. The capitalists don't want any more people. They don't want any people, apparently. They don't. They seem to think. I think they're wrong in that because you have to sell to somebody. You have to make something. Capitalism used to be people who made something. It just didn't clip coupons. Now this interest in mortgage thing, they don't create anything. They don't make anything. Roosevelt wrote a wonderful book in '33 about that. About the responsibility of capitalists, that you could have a capitalist WPA and make shoes for everybody in the world. Most people are barefoot. And you could keep capitalism alive, he said, for another 100 years if they didn't become so greedy and destroy the source of wealth. When the ERA was proposed, a lot of radicals, including myself, was against it because it seemed like a white middle class movement and would actually do away with a lot of things that the working women like being treated equal, do away with their, you know, with their special restrooms and so on. But then I changed my mind and supported it. But I still think it's very racist in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, it's white middle class. What's good for white middle class women? But I think it's important to pass such a law. But it's just like the segregation law. It's going to mean nothing if the same power is in power. I mean, that all of that struggle now is being wiped out by now. But it's important to struggle on those lines. It's, you mean, struggle to fight the doing away with the segregation law. Anti-segregation laws and the laws of health for workers is being smashed. We have to really fight on those, or they'll all be just wiped out. That was a long struggle, you know, to get those laws. I know a man has a broken back in Minneapolis in the hospital yet in 32 because he was for Social Security. I mean, that was a radical, dangerous thing. He was thrown down the stairs, and unemployment insurance, they were all written by workers. And they were considered very radical. And mortgage moratorium, all those laws were actually created by the Depression, by workers' organizations in the Depression. In fact, the New Deal, they actually took laws from North Dakota that were written by farmers. The Social Security law and was taken verbatim from the Nonpartisan League. These were written by farmers when the Nonpartisan League was in power. Corporation laws to curb corporations. All those New Deal laws were created by the workers and farmers. It wasn't. We think now it's Roosevelt. He just had the sense to save his class, but he didn't create all that. The WPA, all that. But we have to struggle for those things, or we'll have no defenses at all. We won't even have food.
I guess we could have another question or two.
Talking about isolation and these philosophies that we were taught, existentialism, isolation, all those, that is the ground of cynicism. If you're not connected with anything, if the object is objectified and outside of you, you can bomb it and not believe in it. I think the main thing is to be part, to go to this march in Washington, for example, to go wherever there's struggle. To go and get as near to other people as you can, to do away with this distance between you and no responsibility. This whole being a consumer, you know, this whole thing has taken us away, has distanced us from reality. Our literature, I mean, Saul Bellow, for example, was a great writer, I think, when he began. He came from the Chicago ghetto, and now he said he was going to get the Nobel Prize no matter what. So he did, no matter what. And now he writes about cynicism. He's distanced from the people that he writes about. His women are horrible, just horrible. I mean, he has no social passion. He has no social feeling. He has no sympathy. Nothing. I mean, he's just a writer about a dying, rotten class of people. They're dying. If you're going to associate with the dying class, you're going to be cynical and pessimistic because they have nothing to do but defend their death and defend their property. I mean, they're willing to drop the bomb in order to survive. You must go where the people have nothing to lose but their change, where there's hope, where there's courage, where there's struggle. you're not going to sit in a room and get rid of your pessimism. You're going to rot further and smell your own pessimism. I think we have to go and be with and be part. I've been part of the Honeywell struggle, for example, in Minneapolis for 8 years. Every Wednesday morning, we have gone to Honeywell to protest Honeywell making those terrible bombs that explode inside of you. Now, if you're going to sit in the city and have, in the middle of the city, and let people sit there and plan, think about bombs that will burst inside of a child, bombs for short people, the terribly called mother bombs made at Honeywell, they're to hit short people and explode inside of them. And they're made of something that the X-ray cannot find, so you can't take them out. You die slowly or fast or from this exploded bomb inside of you. Now, how can you not say something about that? Or how can you not, if you're going to just let that happen in your city, then you're for death. You're for death. I mean, I think we have to choose between life and death now. It's just simple. You're either for death or you're for life. It's wonderful because it's so simple. If you do nothing, you're for death. If you do nothing, you're just as much for death as the people who press that button.
I think we have maybe one more question. And
she wants me to tell a little about my personal life.
Can I ask something, too? Because there hasn't been that many questions from women in the audience, that we have a couple more.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, I like it. It's not too late. Women question. Well, it's I really wrote all my personal life. I think my work is my personal life. I mean, because it's a struggle to survive. My writing is my struggle to survive, I think. You know, I'd be in an insane asylum or dead if I hadn't struggled to express my life as related to all women's life or related to all life. So I had to struggle to make a living. I raised two children by myself. I had to struggle to get an education. I left school in high school and because I wanted my own education. I was really raised in the socialist movement, really. And 15, I was living in the anarchist house in New York with Emma Goldman. So I never became an anarchist, though. I never liked the anarchists, for one thing. That's very personal, but they weren't very anarchistic, it seemed to me. So then my mother wanted to be an actress, so she sent me to dramatic school, and I tried to fulfill her her desires, but I was not an actress. I was very timid and shy. And besides, I was, at 14, I was devoted to the social movement. I mean, I was, you know, I went to Ludlow when I was 14. I was there, I was a reporter. I call myself a witness to, and I think that's what my writing probably is. That's what all writing should be. I mean, Ezekiel and the Bible, all the big prophets, you know, witnesses to what happened there. So I wanted to, and then I didn't, but I had to make a living. So I became a stunt actress in the Perils of Pauline. Get quite a lot of money a day if you lived. You had to sign it. You have to sign something. If you were killed or wounded, it wasn't their fault. It was yours. You had to bury yourself. But you could make about $25 a day, and then I could hold up and try to write. You save it and try to write. So that was in the 20s. And the theater, you know, was not anything to be in. The little theater I was in then for a while. But I couldn't. I had to make a living. And then came. I became really part of the struggle of the unemployed, and then I became a reporter for the Middle West, sort of. I reported in the New Republic and Nation in the West about the drought, about the struggles. The 34 strike, Teamster strike, I wrote a piece called I Was Marching, which became quite famous. It still is in anthologies and so on. So I sort of entered that world officially. Respectfully. So from then on, I wrote social, but now my story, The Girl, was in my daughter's basement 40 years, unpublished. I mean, it wasn't the women's movement really brought, made a market for The Girl, made an audience. job I had was in the latrine of the bus station. And they came and said, well, you can get a job for about a week. And the boss would say, the FBI has been here and I have to fire him. And then I had a class of writing. Anybody who came to my writing class lost their job or they were interviewed by the FBI. But then I had got a post office box to have a correspondence course. In 2 months, anyone who took my correspondence course was visited by the FBI. So, you know, they opened my mail apparently. So that was a Smith Act came along, and, you know, it was a tremendous social struggle that came through my life. Two wars, depressions. But it's been great. That's really a nutshell of some kind. You took that down. That'd be invaluable for the next FBI raids. We're going to have something worse than if they carry out the laws they're trying to pass now in Congress. You can get arrested for thinking. Or for just looking like you're thinking. I don't think the American people will be so gullible. Oh, well, no, I don't think so. That's just the truth. I can't help if the truth becomes cynical. Change being a woman, that you keep you impressed. I mean, I suppose if I had gone in and some way made what is called success, I don't know, if that's just a silly supposition. But I just never, I was with other women who were also oppressed. It wasn't just myself. I also kept with women, the women's movement, who were oppressed, like in the Depression. I lived with those women, not from any. I had to. I mean, I was also unemployed and also hungry. So I just never occurred to me not to keep on struggling. Marriage and children, and it never changed for me. The oppressor never changed. I think I'd have been, to flee the struggle. It never occurred to me. I never had the opportunity, you might say, either. Well, I did have the opportunity. I was really seduced by so many opportunities came to me. I could have left that world, you know, and gone into the money-making world. Well, one time, I was what's her name? The cook in Pillsbury Cook.
Betty Crocker.
Huh? I was Betty Crocker. That was probably made more money, more seduction to get into the swimming pool world. For 1 year, I was Betty Crocker. We got a tremendous, what was me, but we have fortune. I was going to, you know, put it, squirrel it all away and then have years to write. But I wrote, it was a, you know, really an advertising job. You had to write it, you had to appear before the advertising, you had to sell it. It was a terrible job. You got, and then you had to read it. This was before television. I was finally, really a good thing I was fired, because they said my voice was too sensuous for the kitchen. It was a damn good thing I got fired. Another year I'd have gotten used to having this bad salary. Did someone say something? A couple of women's questions. Well,
I was wondering why Tante Gary would be good for the working class. I didn't understand why you said it was more
Why what?
Why the ERA was more a white middle class women's movement than for all women, like the working class women.
What? why there was a between the white middle class and working class women?
For the ERA.
Well, there's different interests. You know, the black women attack the feminist movement, white feminist movement. They have different interests. For example, in Copenhagen, I think this brings it out clearly, they were very influential, the white middle class women at the International Women's. In fact, Regan's daughter was one of the leaders of the, and the white had in their program said the main struggle of women was against male supremacy. And the black women just laughed. So that's not our, hunger is our problem. We have no time to attack male supremacy. I mean, you know, our children, we're hungry. And they had a big struggle about it. The white American women got very angry. They didn't respond. I heard their report in New York, and they didn't see the point at all. They were just attacked by a bunch of primitive women. That was their response. There's going to be a really sharp fight in this meeting about that. So they, and Indian women, many of the white women, feminists have tried to destroy Indian women's, because they have different problems. They don't have the same problem. In California, they have a big thing with Oriental women, also in the feminist movement. But it makes a point of growth. It's not, you know, they have to grow into understanding that problem. And they are, I think, they are. One more?
What's your opinion of women in power, like Indira Gandhi and Margaret Thatcher?
Well, I think the women, that's another problem of women, to learn how to use that, to go into that power. My impression of her was that she was, did, you know, was quite a woman in her feeling and in her power. I haven't made a study of it. But I see here that women going into power roles in the male world, it's a very be a problem. I wouldn't be a feminist so I could have power in the male world. You know, so my mother was a kind of a feminist who wanted equal pay and equal jobs. I'm for that, of course. But I don't want to take over the power. I think women have to bring some feminine, different kind of organization, different kind of concepts. I'm a feminist because I believe the patriarchal world is dying because they've wasted the women's intelligence, women's knowing of what is the feminine, not just, I don't mean by feminine just women either. I mean, men have destroyed the feminine themselves. If they were nourishing the earth and nourishing their own feminine feeling of mothering, they wouldn't be destroying the earth either. I think women have, I see the young women, some of them, very disturbed by that problem. You know, get a career, then you move into that power world, and then you're still exploited in the power world. You know, there's lots of struggle about, you know, you're still a woman, you don't get as much money, and you're used and oppressed in the male world. Some young women are really disturbed. Some of them, we have a problem of even suicide in some, you know, because of this swift change and a tremendous discussion of how to act in a power situation. It's a problem. I have many women now come and rise up and say, 38 or 39, came in the time of the pill, you know, could have many relationships, and they, at 38 or 39, they cry out and say, we don't have any bonding relationship. You know, we don't have any partner that is there, and we don't have any children. They may have a good career even, and they really suffer from, you know, what's the answer to that problem? And not bonding is not the word. What do you call when you look for a
nurturing?
But there's meaning a bonding, meaning a permanent relationship between a man and a woman. You know, well, you know, they don't have that. They've had sex, which my time didn't have. But not, they're very unhappy with that. I mean, that isn't, it's a certain kind of sex, probably. But they haven't had the anxiety of getting pregnant, so it's change is so swift. It's really very, as I say, we've had tremendous problems in the women's movement with suicide and with hysteria and actually losing their mind. We have now a clinic in Minneapolis just for women, you know, to try and talk about those problems. And then there's all the women having children alone also. That's an experiment that's taking place. I have a granddaughter who has two children, raising them herself. Sometimes I think it's almost worse than my time because you have so many choices. We didn't have too many choices. I mean, you could get married or you didn't have a family or you had a career. You almost had to choose. But it's wonderful. I wouldn't go back to my grandmother for anything. I mean, you know, her poverty of sex, her muteness, her loneliness. My mother...